You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Welcome. I am Ted Geyer. I'm the co-director here of the Economic Studies Program at Brookings. And today we are going to explore an issue that has been receiving a lot of attention lately, which is what to do about banks that are deemed too important to fail. Earlier this spring, the Senate voted unanimously, although symbolically, to end taxpayer subsidies to large banks. Senate sponsors Sherrod Brown and David Vitter have said they intend to move additional legislation that goes further. Banks with assets of more than $500 billion would be forced to fund at least 15% of those assets with equity, with the intent of forcing the largest players to split up into smaller firms. Other members are also pushing legislative action. But opponents of the legislation say that Dodd-Frank will prevent the need for any future bank bailouts, that new capital standards mean the system is already significantly safer, and that breaking up the big banks would be harmful to the economy. To discuss these issues today, please join me in welcoming our distinguished panel. First, we have Thomas Honig, who is the vice chairman of the FDIC. Prior to joining the FDIC board in 2012, he was the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City and a member of the Federal Open Market Committee. Mr. Honig was with the Federal Reserve for 38 years, beginning as an economist and then as a senior officer in banking supervision during the U.S. banking crisis of the 1980s. Our next panelist, Rajan Kohn, is senior chairman of the law firm of Sullivan & Cromwell. He's been called the trauma surgeon of Wall Street by the New York Times. He was involved in a number of negotiations during the financial crisis, including advising Fannie Mae, Lehman Brothers, AIG, and J.P. Morgan Chase. The Times somewhat grudgingly conceded in its article about him that it was, quote, difficult to drum up rage against a man who is so mild, courtly, and uncommonly unassuming. Indeed, in dozens of interviews with clients, competitors, and government officials, it was difficult to scare up a critical word about him, end quote. Our third panelist today is our own Martin Bailey. He is a senior fellow in the Economic Studies Program, where he directs the Brookings Initiative on Business and Public Policy. He previously served as chairman of the President's Council of Economic Advisors. Martin's also a senior advisor to the McKinsey Global Institute, a member of the Squam Lake Group, and is the co-chairman of the Bipartisan Policy Center's Financial Regulatory Reform Initiative. So we have a great lineup of panelists today, and I think you should have their full bios in your packets, which were at the front desk as you came in. The panel will be moderated by my colleague, Doug Elliott, who is a fellow in our Initiative on Business and Public Policy. I'll turn it over to Doug now, and thank you again, everybody, for coming, and look forward to the conversation. Thanks.
Thank you, Ted. Thank you, everyone, for being here today. I can tell by the size of the crowd and the many people we know who are hooked into the webcast, this remains a hot topic for people. First, let me thank our panelists again. It's wonderful to have you here. It's a good group of people. Someone had asked me why we called this too important to fail, since many people have been referring to this. Generally, they refer to it as too big to fail. The reason we chose that, just so you're aware, is because we think there are multiple factors. Size is important, but there are other things that help determine whether an institution could be allowed to fail in a severe financial crisis. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to each of the panelists to talk for about 15 minutes, and I will start turning red slightly before the 15 minutes, then I'll start waving my arms and everything. So we'll try to keep this on schedule so that there's time then for me to ask them a few questions and then get questions from the audience. So again, thank you. Tom?
Well, thank you very much, Doug. And I want to start by telling you I'm also impressed by the size of the crowd, which means this is a very important topic and one that we should, I think, consider, maybe debate, at least discuss extensively, because I think it has enormous implications for our financial system and our economy. And from my perspective, I think important is the right word, not big, because it is the issue of how we will choose to use the government's facilities and its subsidy to allow these very important institutions to continue to take on risk and really influence our economy in the long run. I certainly think size is a part of it, because if you consider the largest financial institution in this country, it has about $2.5 trillion of assets using U.S. accounting systems, which is 16% or the equivalent of 16% of our GDP. And if you use a broader accounting system, the international accounting system, and bring some of the derivatives onto the balance sheet, it's a $4 trillion organization, 25% of our GDP. If you think about the eight largest G-SIFs, U.S. G-SIFs in the United States, using U.S. accounting, they have about $10 trillion. That's about 60% of GDP. But if you bring their derivatives onto the balance sheet, it's the equivalent of $16 trillion, which is as large as our gross domestic product. But it is not just their size that has the implication. It is the complexities that have been allowed them as we've allowed the safety net to be extended to ever greater number of activities for these and similar institutions. With Gramm-Leach-Bliley and then with other implied actions by the government, we've extended the safety net to an ever larger number of risk activities. We now know that commercial banks, or at least commercial holding companies that own commercial banks, can engage in and broker-dealer activities, trading activities, derivatives activities within the safety net as it is structured in today's world. Now, what that has done is it has forced broker-dealers who are outside the safety net to either be absorbed by these banks, thus increasing their size and complexity, or it's required them, these broker-dealers, to become more bank-like. And that's where we use the advantages, if you will, of the money markets that were presented as deposits or repos, which then was expanded to allow long-term assets to secure overnight funding that allowed then the increase in the leverage. This, of course, has brought forward the issue of whether they were too complicated, too large, too important to fail. And this perception by the public, which I think remains today, brings with it many important advantages. They include a view that if I am a creditor and I place my money with them, I can depend on the government to repay me. I don't have to look to the strength of their balance sheet or their income flows. That means that over time they do have a lower cost of capital and a lower cost of funds to expand their balance sheet and their operations. This is a very significant advantage over the long term for these institutions, as seen by the increase in concentration, the reduction, I think, in competition, and the advantages that go to them, which then is reflected in the subsidy that is too important to fail, or too big to fail, or too complicated to fail. And this subsidy has been documented through current times. It's not just before the crisis, by many independent studies, academic and otherwise. And it remains with us today, and it is worth billions of dollars to this industry. So that is an enormously important advantage. And one of the things that I think you can see in this is the ability to leverage the balance sheet for these institutions. One of the things in your handout is a table, which is capitalization ratio for globally systemically important institutions or banks. If you look at that, and you don't have to look at it now, you can look at it later, but the point I want to make is if you look at the highlighted column to the right, using international standards, which allows for booking some of the derivatives, you see that their leverage ratio, which is tangible capital to total tangible assets, for most of these institutions, these largest institutions today run between 3 and 4%. If you go to the bottom and you look at the largest institutions that are non-SIFIs, the largest 10 non-G-SIBs, the largest 10 up to 50 billion, and the largest 10 up to a billion, you see that they have almost double the amount of tangible capital. So the advantage of leverage goes to those who are subsidized and protected. And that's really part of the issue we have to face. Now, Dodd-Frank is an effort to address some of these, but it doesn't change the incentive of the subsidy. The subsidy remains either an explicit deposit insurance or implied guarantees because of the importance of these institutions. And if you don't change the incentives, in the long run, you won't change the outcome. And we will have very leveraged, highly vulnerable institutions that will impact our national economy and our national financial system. In the long run, it invites instability, in my opinion. So how do you change this? A colleague and I have proposed not to break them up by size, but to rein in the safety net to whatever it was intended. That is, it would cover the narrowly defined commercial banking activities, which are the payment system, which is part of the reason we have that deposit insurance, the intermediation process around that payment system, some of the asset management responsibilities, some underwriting and trust activities. And then to take the broker-dealer activities, the trading and the derivatives activity, and separate them into different corporations, where then for the directors and the management, things are aligned in terms of what their mission is relative to the safety net and relative to the market and what these broker-dealers can do in a competitive, less subsidized, if not non-subsidized, market environment. Now, I think that's important because one of the other elements of this is the broker-dealer business. When the Gramley's body was opened and these institutions had become more bank-like, it also introduced them to leveraging up and using these money markets. So that also, the shadow banking system, has to be addressed as well. And what we said is, as the SEC is beginning to do, and that is money markets should be marked at value daily, net asset value on a daily basis, so the investor knows they're making an investment, like the stock market, not a deposit that's guaranteed. And secondly, we need to review and amend the bankruptcy laws again to where they can't use long-term assets to subsidize overnight or to securitize overnight funds in the repo market so that then you are matching your assets and liabilities in that market, which is what we used to do before 2005, and that law was changed to the advantage of using leverage for these shadow banks. What does this then proposal contribute? It means that you have clear lines of activity. You've confined the subsidy to what it was intended. You've allowed then the non-bank activities to become, again, market-driven for capital, market-driven for innovation. I think you'll have a more competitive industry as we once did in this country with our investment banks on a global basis. Now, there are those who say and oppose this. One of those examples is we will not be able to compete internationally, and I think that's wrong. I think, number one, it is a mistake to subject the American public to subsidizing our ability to compete internationally in the first place. Second of all, I don't think it's necessary because history tells us that when we have a market-driven, innovative financial system that is not subsidized, we lead the world. That's been our history, and I think that is our future if we go this direction. I will close by reminding those, since we're in an area where economists reside, that Adam Smith had more than just the invisible hand to tell us about. The first thing he said is specialization can increase productivity, and I suggest in this industry it would do much to increase productivity, innovation, and I think overall benefits to our economic system. The second thing he said was to remind us that we should be very skeptical of those who come forward with plans that are driven by the industry that we are dealing with. In this case, because their objective is to broaden the market and narrow the competition, as he noted, and broadening the market is a good thing. Narrowing the competition imposes on the public a burdensome tax, and that is what I think we have done with too important to fail. And I think we should change it so we have a more stable, more innovative, more competitive, and we once again lead the world in an innovative market environment. So thank you very much, and I look forward to the dialogue afterwards. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom. So next we'll have Raj and Cohen. Raj?
Thank you, Doug, and good morning. I'd like to begin by expressing my appreciation to Brookings for hosting this discussion and to Tom and Martin for being willing to discuss these matters in a thoughtful manner and, in each case, for their service to the country. The debate over important banks is best advanced when the participants bring light rather than heat to their arguments. Now, my purpose today is to try and continue promoting an informed and forthright debate in two respects. First, by attempting to dispel some of the confusion that has arisen in this debate, and second, attempting to address some key myths that are increasingly dominating the debate. At the outset, I think it's essential to distinguish between two different, albeit somewhat related, arguments that are often confused. The first is that we must deal with too important to fail. The second is that we must deal with too important. There's close to universal agreement, I think, that too important to fail is an unacceptable policy and an unacceptable result. Too important to fail creates moral hazard, it produces marketplace distortions, it is inequitable, and of most importance, it represents a potential call option on the taxpayer. And Title II of Dodd-Frank is designed to preclude the implementation in the future of too important to fail. If a systemically important financial institution is resolved, shareholders must be wiped out, responsible management removed, and creditors bear any loss. Of most importance, the taxpayer can bear no loss. In addition, the individualized assistant programs utilized in 2008 are now barred. So where the real argument exists today is whether some banks are just too important. Four rationales have been advanced in support of such a proposition, and let me briefly discuss each. The first is that large banks are anti-competitive. In other words, our normal antitrust laws and even the two bank-unique 10% nationwide caps don't work, and we must do something more radical. I've just seen no empirical evidence to support this proposition. For example, I've seen no suggestion that banks and communities in which the largest banks are not present would charge lower rates on loans, impose lower fees, or pay a higher rate of interest on deposits. The second rationale is that large banks are more risky than small banks. Hundreds of small bank failures in the 2008-2012 period and in the late 1980s should refute that claim. I'm not arguing, to be clear, that large banks are inherently less risky, but rather that risk is not a function of size. A variant on the second rationale is that complexity, which resides almost exclusively in large banks, is correlative with risk. Again, the proposition is belied by the facts. The failures of the GSEs, WaMu, Northern Rock, and numerous U.S. depositories had nothing to do with complexity, but conversely, with their one-dimensional business model. The third rationale is that no future Congress or administration will ever trust Title II to work and will instead adopt a bailout approach in response to a potential failure. Now, I would not be so bold as to predict what any future Congress might do, and I acknowledge that there can be no absolute certainty whether Title II will work until we're there. But I would suggest that today and for the foreseeable future, the one issue on which you could attain congressional unity is a proposed bailout. My prediction would be 435-0 and 100-0 and not in support. The fourth rationale is the most fundamental and appears to underlie the first three. This is a view that large banks are bad for our economy and inimical to our economic system. Now, the advocates of this rationale are mining a rich tradition of anti-bank sentiment in American political history. It begins with the historic debates between Jefferson and Hamilton and their contrasting visions of agrarian and urban societies. It continues with the 1832 presidential election and President Jackson's platform of rejecting a charter extension for the Second Bank of the United States. And arguably the most direct political ancestor was William Jennings Bryan with his Cross of Gold platform in multiple presidential campaigns. But before this rationale can be accepted as the justification for the extraordinary action of breaking up the largest banks, there would seemingly need to be a much more considered and an empirical analysis of the methodology of a breakup and the resultant impact. Three other brief comments on the two important argument. First, it is true, the largest banks have grown in size over the past few years, but let's place it in perspective. They have market shares which are far below the largest companies in a number of other U.S. industries and far below the market shares of the largest banks in other countries. In the U.S., the four largest banks account for about one-third of the revenues. That compares to 48% for big oil, 77% for the big automobile manufacturers, and 90% for the big computer manufacturers. To use another metric, the ratio of the five largest U.S. banks' assets to U.S. GDP is about one-third the G7 average ratio. Now, the second and ancillary argument is that the largest banks have grown in size since the financial crisis, and that demonstrates that legislative and regulatory restraints on size have been ineffective. But does this argument pass on close examination? All or virtually all this growth is attributable to the rescue acquisitions of 2008, WaMu and Bear Stearns by J.P. Morgan, Wachovia by Wells, and Merrill and Countrywide by Bank of America. And indeed, some level of growth should have been expected in a consolidating industry and a now growing economy. There is seemingly a contradiction in the views of those who both want large banks to lend more and to shrink more. The third argument is that Title II has not worked to end too big to fail, as demonstrated by the continued lower funding costs of the largest banks in relation to smaller institutions, a point which Tom made. Now, there's substantial debate over the extent or even existence of a lower funding cost. I personally get lost in all the Greek letters, but what I have not seen disputed is that the largest companies in many industries have lower funding costs than smaller companies. And this may suggest that the lower cost of funding in the banking industry has very little, if anything, to do with subsidy, and more because they have greater liquidity, and size, in the view of many, creates risk reduction. Also notable here is S&P's recent announcement of outlook downgrades. Now, in analyzing what more, if anything, should be done to deal with the issue of too important, I think it's essential to recognize that the last several years have already seen substantial additional regulation, restriction, and financial penalties imposed on our largest banks. The most comprehensive regulatory approach is, of course, Dodd-Frank's enhanced prudential supervision. Dodd-Frank also supplemented the 10% nationwide deposit cap with the new 10% nationwide liability cap. And the Tester Amendment shifted literally billions of dollars each year in annual FDIC premiums from the smaller banks to the largest banks. Federal Reserve has followed with this in many ways, and perhaps the best example is from the preamble to their enhanced prudential supervision proposal, where it is stated that a basic objective of the proposal is to encourage large banks to, quote, reduce their systemic footprint. It should also be recognized that this special regulatory approach for large banks represents a departure from the regulatory treatment of every other American industry. You don't have a 10% cap on any other industry in this country, and we don't ask the largest oil companies to contribute to a special fund because of the greater potential impact of an oil spill. In my last few minutes, let me turn to three myths that have pervaded the big bank debate. One of the most enduring is that uninsured depositors and non-deposit creditors of small banks are at great risk in the event of failure, whereas the creditors are fully protected at larger banks. If not a total myth, this is substantially exaggerated. For decades, the FDIC has followed, in my view, a very prudent and wise, but it is still their policy of protecting the uninsured depositors and other creditors of smaller banks in the event of the bank's failure. The FDIC arranges for a transfer of assets and liabilities to a successor bank and provides substantial financial assistance to the transferee. With respect to the creditors of large banks, they were not universally protected during the 2008 financial crisis. At Washington Mutual, creditors of the holding company and subordinated creditors of the bank were consigned to receivership estates, and the original Wachovia transaction provided no certainty for holding company creditors. TARP and other assistance programs followed this pattern. Hundreds of smaller banks benefited from TARP, but there the government didn't do so well. Every bank with greater than $50 billion in assets has repaid its TARP investment, producing returns of approximately $20 billion for the government. In contrast, there are over 100 smaller banks that have not yet repaid TARP, and a number have failed with losses to the government. The second myth is that before we had so much consolidation in product and geographic expansion, the banking system was much safer. This ideal of some sort of halcyonic past is refuted, however, by a clear-eyed view of what actually happened. The leading example is the extraordinary wave of failures between 1982 and 1993, all before Graham Leach Bliley, all before Regal Neal, when approximately 2,320 depository institutions failed. And these weren't just small banks either. At one point, Continental Illinois was the sixth largest bank in the country and widely proclaimed. The third myth has a similar ring. The assertion that the Glass-Steagall Act was necessary because a root cause of the collapse of the banking industry in 1929-33 was bank securities affiliates. Rarely has such significant legislation been enacted on such a demonstrably false premise. During the congressional debates, there was only one example, frequently cited but only one, of bank securities activities purportedly causing a bank failure. That was a bank called the Bank of the United States. It was very notorious. It was the largest bank to that point in time ever to have failed. But it was not because of its securities affiliates. It failed, even though that was what was said in Congress. As the seminal work on the Glass-Steagall Act demonstrates, the affiliates of Bank of the United States that caused its problems, its failures, were engaged in the very same activities that cause most bank failures, real estate lending and investing. And indeed, it appears that not a single bank with a large securities affiliate during the late 20s and 30s failed. So in conclusion, a decision to break up the country's largest banks, whether directly or by imposing unbearable regulatory requirements, would represent an unprecedented departure from our basic economic framework and from the basic relationship between the federal government and the private sector. Accordingly, I would suggest that the advocates of a breakup should be assigned the burden of proof, and a heavy burden. They should be required to demonstrate that a breakup would produce a safer and sounder banking industry that could better serve its customers and the economy. And that demonstration, in turn, should require an empirically based and informed analysis of the benefits and risks. Thank you.
Thank you, Raj. So next we have Martin Bailey. Martin?
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here, and a little daunting to follow two such terrific presentations. I'm going to do something a little bit different, and that is pick up on one of the themes here, and that is the resolution of large banks. I guess I'm tempted to start that I come here today not to praise large banks, but to bury them. Now, I have to qualify that a little bit. I agree with a lot that Rajan said about the benefits of large banks, but I think what I want to say is if large banks get into trouble, we can now, I think, have a way to resolve them without disrupting the economy, without disrupting the financial system. Okay, so this is a victory. I think it has 1,000 fathers, of which probably the FDIC is the leading one. but I think the Fed was also involved. The Clearinghouse had a very interesting paper that described the process that's being developed there. And this presentation that I'm giving is based heavily on the work that was done at the Bipartisan Policy Center, the initiative on financial reform that that Ted mentioned earlier. So the idea with the single point of entry is that you go into a bank at the bank holding company level. There are certain requirements that are placed on the bank holding company about what assets it's required to hold. It's required to hold a debt and equity cushion or buffer that is available in the event that the subsidiaries or the bank itself gets into trouble. One of the problems that's always been difficult with resolving large complex banks is that they have operations overseas. And that there remain some considerable difficulties about how we would resolve that. Clearly, we have not worked out all the pros and cons, dotted all the I's and crossed the T's with the Europeans, but I think there is progress being made there. More importantly, the idea of going in at the bank holding company makes the cross-border issue much easier because you do not, at least immediately and maybe not ultimately, have to put the subsidiaries, the foreign subsidiaries, into bankruptcy. They can, if you're doing this overnight or over a weekend when a bank gets into trouble, the subsidiaries, the domestic subsidiaries and the foreign subsidiaries can open up the next morning and be operating as usual. So you don't quite get the same concern that you're shutting down an important bank in Europe somewhere or in Asia somewhere. One of the issues to make this work is liquidity financing must be made available. I'll say more about that in a minute. And obviously an issue, and it's come up in the previous two sets of comments, that if this is really going to eliminate the implicit subsidy to large institutions, then everybody, investors and so on, have to be convinced that there really are losses going to be taken at the holding company level, the equity and subordinated debt at the holding company level, not by taxpayers. Now, I think you were made available these slides. I hope so, because I'm not sure that those of you without binoculars would be able to read all the numbers on here. But basically, this is just a schematic representation of a complex institution that has a U.S. bank, that has a foreign branch, that has a U.S. broker-dealer and a foreign broker-dealer as well. And so this is just a simplified version of what that balance sheet might look like. There is a total of 100 of debt and equity at the holding company, and each of the subsidiaries have equity. They also have advances or money that came down from the bank holding company that allow them to operate. So everything in this situation is fine. This large bank is operating normally. Okay, so what happens now? In this representative example, all of the main subsidiaries get into trouble. In other words, they've made bad loans. They've done the kinds of things that happen in the crisis. And we now have a situation where both the overall bank and the subsidiaries are inadequately capitalized. They cannot meet the capital requirements, and they need to be – this institution needs to go through resolution. So what happened in the crisis there? Well, we didn't have really the option. We hadn't thought through the option of how would this would be done. So Lehman was put into bankruptcy, which was a fairly chaotic situation and to some extent triggered the massive worsening of the financial crisis, a big drop in the level of equities and a lot of worldwide angst as well. So this was something that we didn't really know how to do or how to do well prior to these latest discoveries or these latest improvements. Okay, so what happens now under the FDI system? Well, what you do is you lift off, if you like, the bank holding company or the FHC, the financial holding company. All of the assets and the subsidiaries are transferred to this bridge financial institution, bridge financial holding company, which I also call at times NewCo. So this is the new company. The original company is lifted off. So all the assets go to NewCo, go to the bridge financial holding company, whereas in particular the liabilities, namely the equity and the long-term unsecured debt, is left at the bank holding company. So that's what's really being lifted off, is these liabilities. Now, given these liabilities are lifted off, and provided there was enough money in this cushion to begin with, that will mean that the Bridge Financial Holding Company and its subsidiary assets are now solvent. Okay, so they are now in a position where they can operate. The liabilities of lifting off, they no longer have obligations to support that long-term unsecured debt or to pay the equity. Now, so this process has the effect of recapitalizing the NewCo or the Bridge Financial Holding Company. There are different ways in which this could happen, and the one that I'm describing here is one that could be done quite commonly, because operating subsidiaries typically, as in the example that was shown here, have intercompany loans from the holding company to the subsidiaries. So as part of this process, part of this resolution process, those loans are forgiven, and in a sense, that is what transfers the lifting off of the liabilities down to the subsidiaries so that they are then recapitalized. They can now operate subject to Basel rules, for example. If the subsidiary doesn't have enough intercompany loans, there are other ways to do this. I don't have the time to go through some of those. But the essence of the thing is to get rid of this cushion of liability that's taken off, which then allows the new institution to be solvent. Now, one problem is that even though the Bridge Bank is solvent, it probably would have trouble trying to cover immediate liquidity needs. So either the Federal Reserve or the FDIC through the Orderly Liquidation Fund would have to provide some kind of liquidity funding, sometimes called DIP or debtor in possession financing, to let the operating company still work. Now, that's a controversial element, because some people look at that and say, okay, you're bailing out the bank because you're providing government-supported money. We don't think that's the case. If you do it through the Fed, then this is essentially lender of last resort activity through the Fed, which has been sort of sanctioned, encouraged since the days of Badgett and the whole development of banking. It would be secured. The liquidity lending would be secured against the assets of the subsidiaries. There would be a penalty interest rate to make sure that this money was repaid in good time, and if necessary, the assets against which the lending was secured would face a haircut, in the sense you wouldn't lend dollar for dollar against those assets. The other possibility is, as I say, out of the Orderly Liquidation Fund of the FDIC, and I hear different opinions about which of these two options would be more like a bailout. I don't think either one of them should be a bailout, but one or the other should be done. One of the advantages of this procedure also is that while I've talked about this as an orderly liquidation authority event, it could also be bankruptcy. And the Bipartisan Policy Center's team really preferred the idea of bankruptcy. So all this process actually could be done by a bankruptcy judge, particularly if you have the right judge or judges that are experienced in handling large financial institutions. There are some amendments that would be desirable in the bankruptcy code, but even as the code stands today, we think it's probably possible to do this through bankruptcy. Okay, again, another somewhat hard-to-read chart, but this simply describes numerically, and you can look in the thing, how the forgiving of the intercompany loans would actually restore capitalization to the subsidiaries and mean that the Bridge Financial Holding Company was now again solvent. One issue I should mention, by the way, that's an important issue that I think we need to say more about is what about reputational risk? In other words, if the name is with if the name, so to speak, is perceived as having failed, are you able to preserve the going concern value of all the subsidiaries? And I think that is again a concern. Generally speaking, the name would go with the bridge financial holding company. But in some cases, obviously, the subsidiaries carry their own or separate names, and that's not an issue. But that, too, is something that needs to be considered and worked out. All right, what about the poor suckers, so to speak, that were left behind with the financial holding company, the failed financial holding company? They're important because one of the issues is how costly is this going to be to financial holding companies to finance this cushion of debt and equity. And by the way, we think it would be better to have some of that in the form of the subordinated debt rather than having all of it in equity. I know there's a view that we need to have all equity, but our view is that you're actually better off to have some of this cushion in the form of subordinated debt. Well, they would be, in our judgment, better off than if you'd gone through the kind of bankruptcy process that Lehman went through, because there you really destroyed most of the going concern value of the subsidiaries. So what they get is once the dust is settled, once you've established your new company, once it's operating, and you may have to have closed down some of the subsidiaries if they were the source of the problem or reorganized the subsidiaries. Once that's going, then the people, the equity owners and the owners of the unsecured debt at the original financial holding company, they will get the residual value. And as long as this going concern is pretty good, and if you look back at what happened over the financial crisis and what value, you know, the very fact that the top was repaid, in a sense, gives you a sense that the long-term unsecured creditors may also get repaid, and maybe even the equity would get some, but not necessarily. They get the residual as they would get out of a bankruptcy proceeding. Okay, so I'm almost finished. I do want to comment, and this has come up in the prior discussions, about the subsidy to large complex banks, because one of the, I think, main reasons why we think it's so important to have this resolution authority or bankruptcy process for large institutions is we want to take away that subsidy or potential subsidy to large institutions. And I'm going to say a word about is it there. Now, I had some of the same trouble that Rajan did with Greek letters reading some of these studies. And I know Greek letters and math probably better than Rajan, or at least I've been trained about that. And it's tough going to read all this literature and to understand exactly what it all meant. My understanding of the main study that's cited and that was covered extensively in Bloomberg is that this study is based on worldwide data and includes a lot of non-bank financial institutions as well as the main U.S. banks. And so I want to follow up with the co-author. I did ask a direct question to Kenichi Ueda. Did you find direct evidence that the large U.S. banks have a subsidy? And my understanding of his answer is that they said no, but it was implied by some of the other work that they did. But their empirical evidence as such was based on this worldwide data. So I think I'm not sure where they come out on that, but I'm not sure they've really demonstrated there was, after the crisis, a subsidy. Now, as I think Rajan also mentioned, a study by Goldman Sachs led by Steve Strongen has argued very forcefully that there's not a subsidy. And he points out that smaller banks are less safe and that there's a difference in borrowing costs between large and small institutions in all industries, and you would expect to find that in large banks. The one thing I think so far that tends to convince me we still have a ways to go in getting rid of the subsidy is from conversations with the rating agencies, and they still adjust their ratings on the basis of whether they think these institutions are too big to fail or too complex to fail, and that they give them a slight ratings advantage on the basis of their status. So my final point here is that if we want to get the subsidy out, we have to convince everybody that this resolution process really is going to work, that we can use it to deal with these large banks, and consequently the costs of the losses that may be faced by these institutions is really going to be borne by the equity holders and the that the long-term debt holders and will not fall on taxpayers. Thank you. I'll stop there.
Let's go ahead and take a seat. We're going to sit the panelists down, and I'll join them. We're going to get mic'd up, so forgive us for taking 1 minute for the logistics here. But let me just say personally thank you again to each of the panelists. I thought they did a terrific job. So one moment. Thank you. Tom, let me start with you. I think by the time I finish, you'll actually be mic'd up. You were admirably brief, for which I thank you. You were briefer than the others. So,
is that right?
Yeah, and you were longest.
More substance.
Exactly. So, Tom, I wanted to actually give you, take 2 or 3 minutes if you'd like, and if you could give a few thoughts that you had based on what you heard from your colleagues up here.
Well, thank you. I thought the comments were good and interesting. I do have some reactions, and let me first start with the idea that hundreds of small banks failed, and we didn't think anything of that. But to me, Raj, that makes the point. In the 80s, and again in this crisis, hundreds of banks, smaller banks, failed. In the 80s, early 90s, there was no Great Recession. They were allowed to fail. It did not bring down the economy. Here, the threat of these very large, interconnected, globally important institutions were at least correlated, if not cause and effect, correlated with an enormous impact on the economy because of their size, their complexity, and their impact to the economy. We had a terrible outcome from that. So my point is that, number one, simplifying this structure, pulling back the subsidy that encourages the risk-taking, I think would be very beneficial to us. It also, to I think a very important point with the simpler system, makes Title I, which actually is Congress's preferred solution to this, which is bankruptcy, much more likely because you have institutions where you can put the bank in receivership, the holding company in bankruptcy, and not have all this fallout that you now have with this very complicated derivatives, liabilities globally of trillions of dollars that are off the balance sheet. So I think simplifying that system would do much to allow Title I to work, which is the preferred, and that's bankruptcy. Title II is, yes, better than pre-crisis because it is orderly as opposed to disorderly, but it is a government intervention in dealing with this, which we fully accept, but let's not pretend that it is bankruptcy in the traditional sense. I also want to point out, people argue about the Great Depression forever, but I did read the Pecora Commission report, and I think there was more than, I think there was much more abuse relative to banks and what then were non-bank affiliates, another form of sieves, which allowed them to leverage up, and I think did contributed to that crisis as well. So I think those are important points as we look going forward. I think there's much work to be done. I think Title I is the preferred, and if you think about that, that's bankruptcy. We need to solve debtor in possession, how you provide liquidity. We need to solve the issue of cross-border under that, and we're a long ways from that. We're working on it. The living wills are designed to make bankruptcy work, not Title II. Title II is the intervention. It does leave operating subsidiaries whole. There's a question of whether all the creditors in those subsidiaries, how they will be treated, and whether they will in fact lose. That's an open question point. So there is much to be done. I think scaling back the subsidy, simplifying, will still leave us a very competitive system, one where institutions can fail without the dramatic impacts to the economy, and in the long run, we will have a better system.
Okay. Thank you, Tom. Now I'm going to take the moderator's traditional privilege and ask a couple questions. So let me start with you, Tom. One of the points that Rajan made, with which I personally agree, is that it would be very helpful to have more empirical work and more cost-benefit type analysis. My question would be, you've put forth a relatively specific proposal, Tom, in terms of some people have viewed it as kind of Glass-Steagall-Lite or however
correct
you'd want to refer to it. Do you have a cost-benefit analysis of that you're comfortable with? If not, how at a more intuitive level have you arrived at the conclusion that the benefits outweigh the costs?
Well, the intuitive part is the fact that we just suffered the Great Recession, that these institutions, their size and complexity, clearly had an impact that worsened a crisis that was evolving, and that we need to find a simpler method to do that. We have worked with others in terms of the subsidy now. It seems every study isn't really sufficient to convince anyone. Whether it's the most recent one, I've got a list of 14 studies on the subsidy, presented these to many people, but then there's always a new objection that that isn't really enough. So I think we can go on quite a while in terms of studies that show subsidies, then studies that show cost-benefit analysis. But I think you also at some point have to look at what in fact happened and what were the contributing factors. And it was that these very large institutions had such a dramatic role within the economy, within the financial system, that when they began to fall away, the economy went into a major collapse. And I think we have to consider ways to deal with that. We put the proposal out and put it out to the broad world and the academic world so that they could, in fact, look at it, study it, and if they have objections, identify those objections in terms of cost-benefit. And that process has not proceeded as I would hope, but I think there's still more that we can learn from that. And I'm very open to different views and to studies that might disprove it. But at this point, I have seen no studies that have disproved it at all.
Yeah, I will say just as a follow-up point, but you don't need to answer it now. One of the things I would love to see with any of these proposals is a sense of how it would have affected the previous crisis if we had it. Because I think we all acknowledge there were multiple causes of the crisis. Some of them would have been related to Too Important to Fail. Some wouldn't have been.
Sure.
But
You have to remember, bad management can make mistakes in enormous ways and enormously different ways. Mm-hmm. And so I don't think that you would necessarily not have bank failures if you had this proposal. We had bank failures before that. Continental Illinois was a bank failure in a much simpler way, but it was an important enough institution that it was, in fact, bailed out. And so it's the size and importance of that institution, then made worse by the complexities that you introduced that are also facilitated by the subsidy that is in place that has been documented. And my point is that you're saying keep the status quo because, yes, we suffered this Great Depression, but or this Great Recession, but really it wasn't the fact that those banks were so important. There had to be other reasons, and in fact, that they were a major contributor to it. They received the TARP was designed for them. Political reasons, it got broader than that, but it was designed for them. That's a huge bailout because of their importance to the system. Would that TARP fund been necessary had they not been so interconnected, had they not been so complicated? I think that's the question. It's a fair question to ask, and I think the answer is certainly it would have been less complicated, and I think we could have dealt with the crisis more productively than we were able to with major bailouts.
Okay, thank you. Let me turn to you, Raj. And let me say I've made many of the same points you have in that I really would love to see better, deeper, and more empirical analysis. But a counter to that, which to some extent Tom just touched on, is I think there's a very real fear that whether it's your intention or not, that this, in fact, would basically slow down the process for a few years, the political will to do anything would dissipate, and that while it might be the theoretically right way to do it, that the practical effect would be to preserve a status quo that doesn't work. What is your response to that?
Well, Doug, let me start by making a clear distinction between slowing down the regulation, which is ongoing and should not be slowed down for additional studies, except there have been occasions, such as a single counterparty credit limit, where the work really hadn't been done and it needed to be done. But generally, I am in no way suggesting we should slow down any of the existing regulatory proposals under Dodd-Frank. That would be a terrible mistake. I mean, there's enough there to know, I would agree with Tom, that we've got to get that done. That's a traditional methodology in this country for dealing with problems, financial, economic, and otherwise, is regulation. It's very different to legislate the structure of institutions and to say you shall be only so large or conduct only very limited amounts of activities. I think Tom was quite clear that he is not breaking it up based on size, but a lot of people are. And so that is such a wrenching change that I think you do need careful, thoughtful study before you take such a step. Let me just give you one example. So some people say, let's go back to where we were. And this has been advocated quite forcefully before we had Regal Neal, before we had nationwide banking organizations. Okay, so let's look what happened. When banks were confined to a single region and you had these rolling regional recessions, the entire banking industry was wiped out. The state of Texas today doesn't have one of the, 30 largest banks in the country? That's because in the 80s, when the oil recession hit, the entire industry was wiped out. They were confined to a single state, a very large state, but still a single state. Much the same thing happened in New England. So I think one needs to be very careful here.
Okay. Martin, I told you I wasn't going to ask a question, but we're actually running slightly ahead of schedule. So let me ask you one, which is how certain are you that Title II would actually be used if it got to the point it needed to be used, as opposed to being preempted by an administration or the Fed or some combination who was too afraid that it might not work and would take actions more similar to the ad hoc actions that we had, the bailouts, in this crisis?
Well, I would quote Doug Elliott to say that we don't know what any future Congress will do, but I think I'd also agree with you that it's very unlikely that they were going to want to step in, particularly if you have a fairly well-worked-out process by which you can deal with these large institutions. And let me expand on that a second with respect to bankruptcy. When Dodd-Frank was passed, we had Title I, which envisaged bankruptcy as the institutions would go into bankruptcy, and the stress tests and the living wills, the living wills are all designed to ask the banks, okay, how would you go through bankruptcy? But we now we also have this parallel process of Title II, which, as it's set up in Dodd-Frank, would be very different. So part of what I think we're proposing in this report on resolving large institutions is that we really want to move the bankruptcy process and the Title II process, the orderly liquidation process, together so that the living wills can serve for either bankruptcy, and that would be the first choice, or to this orderly liquidation authority. So I think my answer to you would be, if an individual institution goes down, as long as the economy is doing okay, I don't see any problem in having institutions go into bankruptcy and be resolved that way. If it looks like we've got a lot of institutions or there's a real overall systemic problem, then I think it's more likely that we will actually end up with an FDIC-operated orderly liquidation authority. I think it's very unlikely that we're going to go to Congress that they're going to step in and take over. I think they would much rather leave it to the FDIC to do that.
Yeah. By the way, I think you were quoting the great Raj Cohen, not me. At this point, let's turn to the audience. I'm sure you have a lot of questions. What I propose to do, as we often do, is we'll take three questions at a time so that we could have a little efficiency in the answers and try to get the maximum number of questions. Please make it an actual question and identify yourself and an institutional affiliation if you have one. So please, over here. And wait for the microphone, please.
Thank you. Bruce McGlory, formerly Brookings. For Tom Honig, the question is, you're dividing up your institutions by function, not by size. And my question, Tom, is whether those institutions that are outside, not formally guaranteed, cannot you imagine them becoming so big or so threatening, so risky, as to threaten the society and the economy outside of your explicit guarantee? One other question, if I could, Mr. Cohen, whether you think that Tom Honig's proposals are, in fact, quote, breaking up the banks, unquote. And Martin, the question is, who is the czar who pulls the trigger and puts an institution into resolution, and by what criteria?
Okay. Please try not to ask three questions. back there.
Bruce gets special prerogative as the former president of Brookings.
I'm Morris Goldstein from Peterson across the street. I wanted to ask the panel about another proposal for dealing with too important to fail, and that would be much higher capital ratios, particularly the leverage ratio. Not 3% like in Basel III, but let's say 15 to 20. If you look at Tom Honig's interesting table, you'll notice that the leverage ratio there for U.S. banks is about 6%, European banks about 3%, even much lower if you handle the derivatives. During the last crisis, U.S. banks lost about 7% of assets, total assets, higher if you looked at risk-weighted assets, Europe maybe 4%. Raj rightfully stressed, well, we need empirical evidence. I'm not aware of any credible study showing that raising leverage ratios much higher than what we have under Basel III would do significant damage to the U.S. Economy or to the global economy, particularly if they were phased in via retained earnings and restrictions on dividend payments over a considerable period of time. Certainly, the cross-section evidence, you look at
I think we're moving beyond a question.
Okay. Let me stop there.
Thank you, Morris. And given all the embedded questions, let's maybe take it at this point, and then we'll come to another round. So, Tom, do you want to start?
Well, first, yes, there's a possibility that outside the system they could become large, but a couple things. Number one, pushing them outside will put them immediately through transition, at least after transition, in a position where the market is defining what they're doing, defining what the capital needs will be, and those capital levels will probably be higher. Secondly, we know that because in an earlier period we had Drexel fail, hardly a blip on the U.S. economy, Solomon fail. They were outside under the market's discipline. But let's say they do get large, that we don't change enough, that they become highly, they can use, if you will, money markets and repos inappropriately, in my opinion, to lever up, and they become too big, then you can, under Dodd-Frank, designate them as significantly or systemically important. But because they are there is a straighter line, you can also handle them under either Title I, the preferred method, put them into bankruptcy as they've done in the past, or if you had to go to Title II, you could do it, I think, in a much more straightforward fashion. So I think the benefits in terms of the simplicity and the ability to put them into bankruptcy are greater. Morris, to your point, I agree that now whether it's 20%, I've suggested that the leverage, the tangible capital asset, be 10% for all banks. Gives you a much more level playing field. Cost of capital is comparable. Pricing of loans are comparable because right now the largest banks do have an advantage, I'm afraid, in terms of their ability to price and go into any market and get it and be able to price more favorably. So I think that would be good. There are studies, Haldane and others, who've said that the leverage ratio is a better predictor of a failure, and we also know from some of the work the IMF has done that when you have these higher tangible capital levels, when you have an economic stress affect you, that the need to pull back on lending is lessened, and that in the long run then, I think we would do much more for the stability of our economy and much more for the stability of credit should we have a higher capital leverage ratio. And I think that the issues around Basel should be what level should that be and what the transition should be to get there that allows the economy to adjust, and we'd be much better off.
Roger.
Let me start, if I may, with the leverage question, and this is probably where I should put in the disclaimer that these are my views only, and clients may hate them in any event. I think you've got to start with the premise that there are serious weaknesses in both a leverage ratio and a risk-weighted ratio, and I think they're fairly obvious. The leverage ratio simply fails to account for risk, and one quick illustration, the decade in this country's history which had the highest leverage ratios, because that's all that was calculated then, was also the decade of the highest level of bank failures, and that was the 1830s. So leverage in itself, high leverage ratios are not the end-all and be-all. Risk-weighted also has a serious problem. And the problem with risk-weighted is that people and models are fallible. And there's a lot of complexity, and maybe people don't understand it. So I think, actually, I would in large part agree with what I think I understood Tom to say. I think they both need to be there, at least for the largest institutions. I think leverage is potentially the more defective of the two, so I would use leverage as a check on risk-weighted rather than the other way around. But to go directly then to Morris's point, I think it is beyond argument that leverage ratios in the neighborhood of 3-4, I don't know where the number is, but where they have been were woefully inadequate. They need to be significantly higher, but I do see them as less, ultimately because of my view that they should be a check, that they should be less than, say, a Tier 1 common ratio under Basel III.
Can I add one thing? First of all, we agree that both should be used. I would use the leverage ratio first, because I think the evidence is that they are, the higher they are, and you set the right level, you reduce the likelihoods of failure. But the risk weighted then picks up the fact that if you over invest in a particular area, the ratio can pick that up, and you can then add to the capital requirement to the institution as it takes on more risk. And I think that's particularly important. And finally, there's no amount of capital that saves you from bad management. From fools. And so that happens, and that's the unfortunate part that we have to deal with.
Okay. Martin?
Quickly, I think our view is that it's not just capital, it's capital plus the unsecured debt. Now, if you think of the unsecured debt as being a cocoa that converts into equity, maybe that's a milder distinction. But I think that should be determined by stress tests, by figuring out what is necessary to in the way of a cushion that is needed to absorb any likely losses under adverse circumstances. In terms of who pulls the trigger, there's some legal issues there that I'm probably not the best person to answer on that. My understanding, at least, it would be the primary regulators of the institution or the board of directors of the institution that would do that, and it would be triggered by a loss of equity or loss of capital that would render the institution not meeting its requirements.
And by the way, Morris, I wouldn't have said anything except you threw in the word credible about studies. I've written actually quite extensively on this topic, including a year-long study for the IMF. I do think there would be significant economic cost in being at the levels you're talking about, so we should talk sometime about it.
Could I just finish on the question on breaking up the banks? Because I think this is a very important question. As I understood, and obviously Tom can speak better about his own views than I did not understand that as breaking up the banks. What I understood was, whether you call it Glass-Steagall Light or an enhanced Vickers. It is saying put the risky activities, which should not be subsidized, in a separate subsidiary and prevent the transfer of the subsidy to that subsidiary. So there were many versions of Volcker, but actually from the beginning, so-called Super 23A was there, and I think that makes a lot of sense. It's hard to argue that this, if there is a subsidy, that it should not be transferable.
Right. Now, I have to clarify, our proposal does suggest they be shipped entirely into separate corporate entities.
Right.
And the reason is that separate, not under the same holding company umbrella, but separate entirely, because when they're under the same holding company umbrella, in a crisis, they tend to merge. The pressures overwhelm, the fences are knocked down, the 23As are exempted, as they were the last time. So your directors have to go that direction because they're trying to survive and they want the company to survive. So you have to take this and put it completely out so that in the crisis, the mission of the directors and the management are clear. Save the institution that is in place, not risk everything as you bring them back together, as we've learned over and over again, that you just cannot put them under the same umbrella and not expect them to reemerge in crisis or come back together in crisis.
Okay, let's take another round of questions here. Up front here.
Thank you. Rob Colorina, AIAC Investment. The question of reputation came up earlier in one of the presentations. My question goes to integration. Do you all keep track of things like, in a merge situation, things like are there new jobs created, or are there new accounts, and at the end of the day, borrowing costs, have there been material difference? And Rajan, you may have some commentary to this, because from the investment side, if in fact there is a win-win, is there a toggle back where there is a mechanism where it would be fair to for risk capital going in below a debt or convertible position?
Okay, thank you. How about just two rows back there, the red shirt?
Thank you very much. Larry Checo, Concerned Citizen. And I would just like to say that I really appreciate the high level of this conversation, but I'd like to bring it down to one word, and that's trust. And quite frankly, I do not trust the financial industry to do the right thing, and quite frankly, I do not trust the government to protect us. We've seen the SEC fold. We've seen Congress fold on us. We've seen the GSEs go right through the whole ranks. My question, I guess, and I think Martin came closest to it, it's reputation. And Mr. Cohen said something about unbearable regulatory requirements. They may be unbearable, but ask the people who've lost so much in this last crisis how unbearable their lives have been as a result. I guess my question is, when can we expect the next crisis?
Fair enough. I've been neglecting this side, so how about the fellow over there?
Great, thank you. Jared Seberg with Guggenheim Washington Research Group. I want to bring the topic back to capital. At what point is the panel concerned that capital levels could actually get too high, that you're not actually getting the banks to break up, but perhaps you're encourage them either to take more risky behavior or to pull back on lending and other things to support the economy?
Okay, thank you. Tom, you want to start?
Jared, first of all, the issue of capital, it's too high, is if, and this is what I think the industry has done, if they've now targeted a return on equity that's 20%, we have a problem. Because that's a hedge fund type of environment, so you have to take on that risk. So it's really a matter of what is the right return given the protections, the certainties of cash flows. I would say that if you, though, judge the right amount of capital based on history and some of the research that's been done, the consensus seems to be above 10% tangible. I've said 10%. you can still have a very good return on equity. We know it does bring greater stability. We know that if you have a strong capital base as you enter a crisis, you tend to constrict less in terms of your lending. And if you have a strong capital base, you're able to have greater flexibility in the lending. So there is no magic number. I think it is based on the history and the evidence, 10% is reasonable. But I think we could use more studies, not about the subsidy, but about a reasonable level of capital and then the transition to that. And I think we would have a much more productive conversation than we're having right now, in my opinion, with Basel III.
Raj?
Let me start with the question on mergers and consolidations. Probably not enough work has been done, and there certainly have been a number of very poorly conceived mergers in the financial sector industry. In fact, if you want to see a correlation between banks that failed or nearly failed and bad deals, it is surprisingly strong. At the same time, it is like so many endeavors in life, well-conceived transactions can be absolutely a win-win. And I'll take one institution. What became Wachovia, the Wachovia First Union transaction, created lots of jobs, created a much stronger bank, and then Wachovia went out and did Golden West, and it was a disaster. So, you know, there are a number of issues, not the least of which is the adequacy of due diligence and familiarity with the product lines that you're buying. But I don't think we should assume the consolidation is either a plus or a minus, but it's something which in the right circumstances could do a lot for the industry. And I'd just like to make one other comment, and that is on the second question. I do think that what was said, the absence of trust and the millions and millions of people who are still out of work, have lost their homes, that's what the banking industry needs to really focus on, because we can rail about Congress or regulators or somebody else, but they're hearing it, and they're hearing from a lot of people who were harmed. I don't think it is appropriate to say that this was all the cause of the major banks. There were a lot of participants in causing the financial crisis, but for the industry, they need to think a lot more about regaining trust. So that's a well said point.
You know, on the trust issue, I understand the point, and I think that I don't think you can necessarily rely completely on our good nature to make sure everything turns out. And that's why I think having the right structure, having the incentives aligned, making sure we're not subsidizing the wrong business that then balloons and creates leverage that gives us then a more stable. So it's the structure you choose as well as the people you choose, and both are critical in this kind of in an economic system, in a capitalistic system that you want to be that you want to have be successful.
Okay. Mark?
Briefly, because I agree with much of what's been said. Yeah, I don't think you can trust institutions. They'll make mistakes or do greed. Greed is a powerful motivator. Government regulators failed on to catch this for various reasons. Some of them were good folks and missed it, and some of them should have seen it and didn't, and all of that. This was in big banks. It was in small banks. A lot of the bad mortgages were originated in state-regulated non-depository institutions. So a lot of the crap came up from below, didn't, and then got up into the system of securitization. So we do need, as Tom said, I agree completely, we need a structure where the incentives are better aligned so that you don't have brokers or small institutions or large institutions that look like they can make a lot of money by taking bad assets and then passing them on to someone else. So that's a challenge that still remains. Can capital be too high? I agree with Doug that it can. There are a number of areas where it's strangely, actually, technical economics is quite important to resolving these policy issues, and trying to understand the nature of the subsidy was one that we talked about. Trying to understand the capital structure of banks is another. Are banks subject to Modigliani-Miller, the theorem that says that capital structure shouldn't make a difference to the cost of capital? I think the banks all say no, and there's now some academic evidence that says no. There are a lot of people who say yes, and therefore there's no real cost to raising the level of capital very high. I think the jury's still out on that one, too, unfortunately, because the academics, as you know, tend to squabble about these results. As an empirical fact, and I've seen this in working with companies not just in the financial sector but in many other industries, that there is a sort of norm around 10, 15 to 20% rates of return for different activities. And so that as long as they're kind of stuck in that range, if you raise the capital level too high, you are going to have an impact, making it difficult for them to raise that level of capital through retained earnings and reducing the scope of their lending activities. So I think that's something that I think you have to be careful of.
Okay, let's take two questions. John, I think you had a question up front here.
Some people at the back.
My question is primarily probably for Mr. Honig. By the way, John Court with the Clearinghouse and also concerned citizen. But my question relates a little bit to, I think in some of your opening statements you talked about how the large banking institutions might have a competitive advantage or that they were stifling competition and financial innovation in the banking sector. And so my question really is, I guess, around the basis upon which you say that. A couple things. One, don't we have existing statutory protections in this country, like antitrust protections, that should guard against that? And if those are insufficient when applied to the banking industry, why? If I assume that you're saying that the large banks have a competitive advantage against the smaller institutions and that the evidence of the competitive advantage is the subsidy that they might, the funding subsidy they get in the debt markets, how do you sort of recognize that when you think about overall funding costs for smaller banks are actually much smaller than they are for large banks? And that's because the smaller banks, which basically have a different business model, and I would argue maybe don't really compete in the same types of markets necessarily as large banks, that those smaller banks have a lower overall funding cost than the large banks, because the large banks choose to tap the debt markets. The small banks don't. They rely on deposit funding. So I guess boiling it down, if the large banks have a competitive advantage, against whom is my question. Thanks.
Okay, we'll take one more. And it's been pointed out I've been missing the back. So I think Alex Pollack, I guess, is back there.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for recognizing the back and the great discussion. Martin, I think Rajan rightly said that big and simple may be more dangerous than big and complex, and notable examples would be Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Would you have recommended applying your resolution regime to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac? And if you had, what do you think would have happened? And to Tom and Rajan, shouldn't we be joining the Europeans in figuring out how to bail in the uninsured depositors systematically?
Okay, so Tom?
To your point, what I've said was that the largest institutions have a subsidy, and I think that's been documented to preponderance of evidence. That is reflected in lower cost of capital, which has allowed then consolidation to go at a much stronger and much faster pace than it might otherwise. If you look at the table, if you look at the tangible capital that the largest banks have to carry versus then the next sets of groups, it's half as much. So that if you go into a market and you have half as much capital that you're pricing against, you can underprice anyone. And you say that the largest banks don't compete with the small banks, ask a small bank in San Francisco who's competing for a business loan that they're not competing with the largest bank.
They have lower cost of funding, the smaller
no,
banks.
No, the largest bank is subsidizing up. They have access to capital, much greater amounts of capital than the smaller banks. It's deposits, but the largest banks have the deposits, and then they have the additional lower costs
in terms of their funding, and it shows in their leverage ratio. They have a much higher leverage ratio, and that allows them, in terms of their competition on pricing, a strong advantage. So they do have those advantages. The subsidy is there. The subsidy is theirs to capture at a greater extent than the smaller bank. That's all I'm saying. If you then take that away, have them compete, push these other activities out, you have a simpler structure. And those largest banks can be put into bankruptcy more easily. I think that's an important fact. And the subsidy comes down pretty dramatically. That's my point. Now, people can disagree with that, but I haven't really been convinced. And the Goldman study that you pay more and so forth is, or you pay less because you're large. Well, that may or may not be, but the fact is you may be paying less because of the subsidy, and you may have been paying even more given the balance sheet that I'm looking at that has a much higher leverage ratio than the other industries. I think it is a bigger point. So I think they would be paying more had they not had the subsidy given their balance sheet and the leverage on their balance sheet than they are, and I think that's the point that I'd want to make. On Alex's point, too big, too complicated. To refer to compare the industry with Fannie and Freddie, which was talk about a subsidized, enormously subsidized organization. I think the point there is that needs to be reprivatized, the subsidy pulled back, and we'll have in the long run, a much healthier housing market as a result. I think it's unfortunate that that it got so out of control that it caused such harm in the housing market and in this country. And I don't think it has anything to do whether it's complex or simple. It's heavily subsidized.
Brad?
The question is a fascinating one on whether we should consider bailing in uninsured deposits. Obviously, it rose to the fore because of Cyprus, and it's not one I've given a lot of thought to, but at least initially, if we'd ever consider something like that, it can't be a surprise. Everybody has to understand. But second, what would worry me, at least initially and maybe permanently, is the idiosyncratic nature of what would happen, because a large portion of the uninsured deposits are a function of the payment systems. And you could have huge amounts. One person could be stuck in one bank for 1 minute and it gets caught. That would lead to, I think, a potential real clogging of the payment systems. Now, again, it's a novel question, but it at least initially it worries me. If I could just add one other quick point, because we spent a lot of time today on subsidy and various elements of that. And there have been several references to the lender of last resort, the Fed, and Martin went back to Badgett. I think it's important to understand why the lender of last resort is there. Banks are supposed to be engaged in several key functions, one of which is maturity transformation. You take short-term funding and transform it into long-term loans. And we've learned a long time ago that the so-called real bills doctrine is great theoretically and is a real problem for the economy. So you're engaged in maturity transformation. That creates, because of the function banks are supposed to perform, the risk of a liquidity issue, even if you're in otherwise very good shape. And that's why you need a lender of last resort. So personally, I think it is a stretch to call that part of the subsidy.
On Fannie and Freddie, oh, wow. I would love to replay history. I don't think I would have set up a system with Fannie and Freddie, or at least if it just started them to get things going and then moved them into the private sector. So if I could replay history, I wouldn't have gotten to the place we were in. Okay, so there we were in the crisis. The housing market was collapsing. Fannie and Freddie were going broke. They had been, I think, misregulated, or, you know, they had like 40 basis points of capital to cover this risk. It was insane. Everybody was worried about interest rate risk when, in point of fact, it was default risk. So it was just a big screw-up. What would I have done? No, I could not really have closed these things down. You had to keep these facilities open to provide mortgages. Otherwise, the economy was going to go way further into the tank. So what I'd like to see going forward, and we did have a conference here and some suggestions about how to move Fannie and Freddie back into the private sector to make this more of a private sector activity. That's what I'd like to see. But no, I could not have. I think you had to. You were forced to keep them going.
Okay. Well, we have run out of time and actually very slightly over. Thank you all very much. And this has been a terrific panel. Thank you.